Hello and welcome to Rational Public Radio. Today we're interviewing Alex Epstein. He's a fellow at the Ayn Rand Center for Individual Rights, and he's also the host of the Power Hour podcast. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're going to get started with a discussion of gas prices, because I know there's a lot of people that are really worried about it. They're seeing the effects from their pocketbook. Why do you think they're so high?
Well, it's important to understand just the basic dynamics of what will cause, you know, any price, including the price of oil, the price of gasoline, to go up or to go down. And basically, it's what you learn in Economics 101. When you have a lot of supply, or when you have an increase in supply relative to demand, you get lower prices. And you have a decrease in supply relative to the demand, you get higher prices. So that's the core variable that goes on. But part of that, part of the demand and the supply equation, especially the demand equation, are people forecasting the future and wondering about and having views on what is supply and demand going to be in the future. So let's say people look at U.S. policy or Mideast policy, or let's just say they aggregate the oil policies around the world and the technology and the economics, and they think, you know, I see a lot more demand coming up, but I don't see as much supply given the policies, given the technology, given the economics. That's going to make them think the future price of oil is going to be higher. And as a result, they're going to bid up what are called futures contracts for oil, contracts that you can buy and sell oil, you know, multiple years down the line. And what that then does is that can affect prices today. So if people are, if we'll say pessimistic about the future, or they're optimistic about oil prices going up, then present prices will go up. And if they're if they think oil prices will go down, if they think there's going to be a lot of oil in the market, then prices will go down. So often we hear of these people called speculators, and they're demonized, but they're really just forecasters, and they're a crucial part of the market. And what they're really doing is, or what their activities do, is they give us a message today of what is the expected outcome for supply and demand and price in the future, and that's a really important mechanism. Otherwise, we can have real shortfalls in the future, not anticipating those.
So do you think that an actual shortage is most of the cause behind prices? Because I've heard a lot of people talking about how high reserves are.
Well, so, I mean, shortage is a technical term, and it's really only something that can be caused by a government, and that's where you literally cannot get something for your money. So, I mean, I said shortfall, which is a little different, which is just that people would want, you know, they'd want more oil at a certain price, and they're not able to get it. You know, for instance, people are used to, let's say, paying $2, $3 a gallon for gasoline, and today they're paying $4, sometimes upwards of $4, and that's what they, you know, that's, so in a sense, that reflects an anticipated shortfall in the ability to get $3 a gallon gasoline in the future. Now, what people will say is they'll look at some factor today and they'll say, well, in effect, they'll say, for some reason or another, I think the speculators are wrong. And you know what? It's possible. There's no omniscience in the market. There's certainly no omniscience for government bureaucrats. So it's possible that people are underestimating the supply that's going on in the market in the future. The real thing that we should be concerned with in terms of government policy is, A, the government lets the market function. So in no way does it try to artificially suppress prices, which is what it did in the 70s, and that's what really caused all the disasters. Because when you artificially suppress prices, you create shortages, and that then people who really, really need oil can't get it no matter what, basically at any price. So that's a complete disaster. But then the more productive thing it can do is it can lift artificial restrictions on production. So in the United States, we have restrictions on almost all of the most promising areas of oil production. Around the world, it's dominated by national oil companies, many of whom stole oil from legitimate producers. We should pay attention to that and call into question why is so much of the oil around the world owned by governments, and not that we should necessarily, you know, that our foreign policy uses force to deal with that, but that should be something we point out in the international discussion. And yet those things are kind of on the back burner, and what people are demonizing are the speculators and the oil companies, and those are the exact wrong targets.
Can you tell me some more about the government restrictions on producing oil in the U.S. and how that affects prices at the pump?
Yeah, so you have basically anywhere that environmentalists have political influence, oil production is, and natural gas production, really the production of anything, is severely restricted. So Alaska, the North Slope of Alaska, Prudhoe Bay, has been that's the largest field in American history, and that was held up for years and years and years by environmental regulations and restrictions. But then there's the whole area of Anwar, which we know has a lot of oil, but with any of these areas, we don't know exactly how much, because it's an inexact science, and to the extent it's forbidden by the government to explore somewhere, there's not the economic incentive and investment to really be able to figure that out. And that applies to most of what's called the outer continental shelf of the country, so places where you drill underwater. And if you look at the case of, say, BP, with deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, which has been a really productive and crucial part of the American economy, you see as soon as something goes wrong, and something did go wrong, but as soon as something goes wrong, people are willing to some people want to scrap the entire enterprise of offshore drilling, which if you look at the economics of that, that is just incredibly scary that could be on people's minds as a response to an oil spill. The real tragedy of which was the 11 people died in an explosion. But just in on the idea that there's no, the fact that there's an oil spill at all, on the idea that we can't have, the fact that there's a possibility of an oil spill is justification for basically banning offshore drilling. That idea has as much currency as it has shows that as a nation we just have an incredibly anti-oil, anti-development policy, and one that doesn't value oil drilling. And therefore it should be no surprise that and other policies that we have tend to drive up prices.
You mentioned environmentalist policy and environmentalist regulations. How disastrous has environmentalism been to American productivity?
Well, I can't really. I mean, there's no number that you can give, and because part of the thing is with any kind of restriction that stops a certain field of inquiry or a field of production or a field of development, you can't know what invisible destruction has been wrought, because if something doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But that said, I'd say it's incalculable. So let's just take the nuclear industry, which is an example that I think is very clear cut and really gets at the nature of the environmentalist movement. I mean, here's a source of power that, despite all the propaganda we've heard, which we can discuss about Fukushima, is compared to any other form of practical power generation, by far the safest, least risky form for those who are concerned about CO2 emissions. It basically emits no CO2, and it has physical properties that are really, really exciting, namely that it has by far the highest energy density or concentration of energy by a factor of about a million, which means you can produce a ton of energy from a very tiny amount of material. And there's different sources for nuclear energy. I mean, you can use different kinds of uranium, thorium, plutonium, although that's unfortunately associated with all sorts of scare scenarios as well. But it's this incredibly potent field, and in the 1970s, you really had a lot of excitement behind it, and they were really starting to produce it in ways that were becoming cheaper than other forms of power. And then the environmentalists saw it, and they saw that it was going to be a large-scale form of power generation, which meant that it was going to be a large-scale form of transforming nature in an industrial way, and they just savaged it. They made up all these scare scenarios. They equated a nuclear power plant, which cannot explode, the nuclear material can't explode in a nuclear power plant. They equated that with a nuclear bomb, which, of course, is designed to explode. They made us terrified of just the terms radiation, radioactivity, even though those are involved in medical procedures like MRIs, and they're involved in just going out and taking a walk and getting sunlight. They so assaulted the field of nuclear that it became impossible for anything resembling a free market in nuclear to exist. So I can't even imagine what the nuclear field would look like had it not been for the environmentalist movement. And this is a worldwide movement. So it's completely wrecked that, and to a lesser but still major degree, it's wrecked the more conventional forms of things. But environmentalism, one interesting facet of it is that the thing it's most successful going after is things that are new. So if there's a new way of drilling, say drilling offshore, drilling into ground that's underwater, they have more success at opposing that than they do just, say, drilling onshore, even though there's no real reason to fear drilling offshore more than drilling onshore, not for any human reasons. Anyway, but so when there's a new technology or a new advancement, that's where they really pounce. And fundamentally, they're hostile to development as such, but they're particularly, it's always easier to oppose something that's untried, that's new, that people can be scared about. So that's particularly where they've been most impactful, with things like nuclear, with offshore drilling, with drilling in Alaska. But going forward, those are precisely the type of innovations that an economy needs. So if you ask how has it impacted American productivity, it's stifled precisely the most crucial innovations for us to go forward.
It sounds like you're saying that environmentalists are preying on people's ignorance, that you know they can't oppose onshore drilling successfully because too many people have seen an oil pump and know it's not a big deal, that they're playing on people's fears, which are really based on an ignorance of information.
Yeah, there's a major element to that. I guess just so everyone is on the same page about it. When I say environmentalists, I mean primarily the leaders of the environmentalist movement. So the Greenpeaces, the Al Gores, the prominent people who say that their goal and whose real goal is to dramatically reduce what they call man's footprint on nature, which means man's impact on nature, which means man's the whole quest of industrialization, which is to transform the world to meet human needs. So the last 200 years where we've turned what was comparative wilderness into a whole modern developed landscape and economy, they view with a great deal of hostility, to say the least. Now, one form in which they rationalize that hostility is to say that it is dangerous, to say that somehow it's industrialization is a threat. Now, if you look at the facts, safety under industrialization is orders of magnitude higher than safety under any sort of pre-industrial system. And all of these, just say even the production of oil, that makes us immensely safe because it builds up a whole infrastructure of hospitals and an internet and police stations and a whole world in which we can be far safer than people in previous generations could ever met. So they make up all of these rationalizations, and as you indicated, those rationalizations are more plausible the newer the technology is, because there's ignorance about it. So it's people are going to be more scared if, for example, someone talks about the threat of radiation, because they don't know what radiation is, and it's this new thing. But in reality, why should you be more afraid of a certain number of millirems of radiation versus, say, the particulate matter coming out of a coal plant? In fact, the particulate matter coming out of a coal plant, it's not the biggest deal in the world, but it's a hell of a lot more dangerous than anything coming out of a nuclear plant.
Well, when you say that they make up these rationalizations, they're actually making up a lot more than just rationalizations, aren't they? They're making up facts, and I don't mean that these are real facts. I mean they're pretend. They with ClimateGate that's broken and all the other scandals now that are continue to come out. They just make up stuff willy nilly. I mean it's just they're lies, right?
Well, it certainly involves lies. But when I say so. A rationalization is kind of a pseudo-rational argument that you put forward because you're trying to get something else over. So often in personal life, people, you know, we've all had the experience where, you know, we feel a certain way and we don't want to admit the real cause, so we make up a rationalization for it, at least feeling that kind of temptation. That happens all the time in just interpersonal affairs. What also happens in intellectual debate, where someone has, for various reasons, a hostility toward capitalism and industrialization, and if they just admitted that they were hostile toward those and they thought it was wrong for man to improve his life by developing the world around him, using huge amounts of energy, he wouldn't get very far with others, and it would be hard for him to even get too far with himself. But if he said to himself, well, no, it's really that, you know, this oil rig could blow up. That's why I'm against it. Now, that's not a real argument, because if you put it in context, well, there's a danger of an oil rig blowing up, but there's also a far, far, far greater danger of not having something like oil to produce the energy you need to live. So it's not a real argument, but it has just enough plausibility to serve that purpose. And in those rationalizations, because they're not legitimate argues, they often involve distortions of fact, out-of-context facts, and then even outright lies. And you see how quickly people will jump on anything that is an indictment of capitalism in industrial civilization. I mean, anything that comes up that seems to be, you know, even let's say the Fukushima incident, people were, the environmentalists especially, but even others, were just chomping at the bit to show how this proves that nuclear energy isn't safe, even though no one died from any nuclear-based cause. I think there was only one accident, you know, one guy, and some equipment fell on him, or he fell on something, which is just a standard industrial accident. So there's such an animus against capitalism and industrialization. It's important for us to realize that and to really think critically when we see people with that level of hostility toward a system that really has tripled human life expectancy.
I think the Fukushima incident is a really telling example of this kind of problem, that I've been amazed throughout the whole process at how safe it was, that the plant survived a massive earthquake followed by a massive tsunami, and there was no meltdown, there was no Chernobyl or really any drama.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole on my show Power Hour, we actually discussed Chernobyl and how even Chernobyl wasn't as bad as what people think Chernobyl is. And Chernobyl was effectively, I mean, a plant design, like a test plant designed by the Soviets with no containment at all. I mean, it was just—it's incredible that so few people died, given how bad it was. But yeah, if you look at the concrete facts of any of these so-called disasters, Three Mile Island, I mean, there were no casualties, no injuries. The only deaths or injuries or whatever occurred from the hysterical evacuation put forward by the government on the idea that this was just some complete catastrophe. Now, it's not to say that there aren't problems in these cases, and we should certainly, or we, really the people involved, should learn certain important technical safety lessons. That's part of any process of evolution. But to treat these as if they prove the danger of this kind of power is, you know, anywhere from dishonest to ignorant, or both, depending on how much information one has access to. But one does have a responsibility. When we're talking about if you find yourself saying, and I'm just suggesting this audience, if you find yourself saying, I don't think X sort of power should exist, you really owe it to yourself and to everyone else. You better know what are the benefits of that form of power, why we use it, and you better know the relative safety risks of that form of power. So it's not just enough to say, hey, something bad can happen when I use this form of power, because something bad can happen when you use any form of power, especially on a large scale. The question is, how much danger is there using this versus those, and how much danger is there using power versus not using power? And it's always, the real danger is not having power.
Can you tell us some of the consequences? What exactly, why is that a danger?
Of not having power?
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, you can do it from a couple of angles, but one is just look around wherever you are right now, whether you're in a room. I happen to be looking outside a window in my office. Look at the world around you and realize that this world around you is completely artificial in a good way. And that is that is completely unprecedented that there are as many things, as much wealth, as much comfort, as much security, as much food, as much clothing, as much shelter, as much transportation, as much leisure, all of these things you have in amounts that previous generations could not even dream of. And one of the fundamental reasons for that is because what we have at our disposal is something previous centuries didn't, and that is enormous, enormous amounts of man-made power. Power that we can feed to machines and have them do far more work than we ever could with just our meager physical strength, or more than animals could with their relatively meager physical strength. So it's like if you think of just your car and how amazing it is that you can drive around and get all these things, or in an emergency you can drive yourself to a hospital. that is something you could never, that could never be done without huge amounts of power. And the question is, well, how do we get that power? And that requires a lot of development of the resources around us, turning black glop into oil, turning, you know, just getting underground land and mining coal, turning uranium into nuclear power. The whole conversion of raw materials to usable power is an essential part of modern life, and it's not an easy thing to do. Now, what the government needs to do is the government needs to not interfere with it, which means it needs to respect the rights of people to develop their own land, to build their own factories, to create power and to trade power, and to not interfere with that process. And if they do that, then we can continue to have the kind of world that we have today. But we should never make the mistake of taking this kind of world for granted, because it is just a completely spectacular thing that you can have so much energy at your disposal. I mean, I've heard estimates that the amount of energy that we have at our disposal producing things for us, doing things for us, is the equivalent of having 600 600 human slaves. It would be like, except there's no violation of rights. I mean, it's amazing.
That's interesting, that particular angle on the production of energy, because the environmentalists often talk about things like sustainable energy. They talk about peak oil. They talk about, of course, alternative energy. If any of these things, you know, I've been around a while, and, you know, I've heard people talking about solar power at least for decades, and have never seen anything beyond maybe a little thing you could put in your car that might maybe in a half a day recharge your cell phone. Beyond that, I've never seen any real practical use for any of this stuff. And certainly if the market saw a use for that, don't you think the market would develop it?
Yeah, a couple things on that. First, let me just, if anyone is interested, let me plug my show, Power Hour, because we actually, you mentioned alternative energy, which we covered in episode one, peak oil, which we covered in episode two, and then sustainability, which we covered in episode three, and then nuclear power is episode four. So if anyone wants to check it out, you can find it easily on Facebook, facebook.com/thepursuitofenergy, facebook.com/thepursuitofenergy, and that'll hook you up with everything you need on those fronts. Now, as far as all of those issues go, I mean, we can talk about any one of them individually, but it's important to look at what unites all of those issues, and that is that they are all pretexts or rationalizations for restricting capitalism, restricting the market. So peak oil is the idea of, well, we're running out of oil, so the government should intervene. Or alternative energy. Somehow the market isn't fair to solar, so the government should intervene. So there's a certain kind of pattern here where it's not just about it's not that people are really concerned that oil is going to run out. Some of them are. But it's that they think that that kind of thing is a justification for that their whole orientation is government needs to be a lot more involved in energy than it is. And as I indicated before, the government needs to be involved a lot less in energy than it is. So with something like oil supplies, peak oil, how much oil there is, that is something that should be resolved by participants on a free market. So different pieces of land, different oil reservoirs, those should be privately owned. People should be free to experiment with things like heavy oil, tar sands, shale, which, you know, if those could be harnessed, we're talking about trillions and trillions more barrels of oil added to the world supply. But if they're not able to harness those on a free market, then the price goes up, and then people are incentivized to find something else. There's no reason at all for the government to get involved. And only if you really don't appreciate or understand capitalism do you think that even that kind of situation with, well, there's only a certain amount of oil, only does that make you jump to, only if you have an anti-capitalist bent do you then jump to the government should get involved. Because what if, let's say there were only 10 more years of oil left. Like, that was it. I mean, fortunately, that's not even remotely the case. But why would that be a justification for the government to get involved? Prices would go up. We'd economize on it. We'd be incentivized to find something quickly, and we'd use it for the most valuable things, since we would have to pay a very high price for it. There's no justification at all for the government to get involved. Certainly not so that we could somehow spread out over the next 1,000 years so we could call ourselves, quote, sustainable. That would just be a sacrifice.
I wanted to ask a question. You keep talking about the anti-capitalist mentality that environmentalists have, and that seems really backwards to me, because whenever I think of communist countries, I think of environmental nightmares, you know, the terribly polluted streets in China and the hideous lakes of pollution in the former Soviet Union. Why don't environmentalists support capitalism, where it seems like things are cleaner?
Yeah, that is an interesting observation. So an environmentalist is someone who is against man's impacting nature. Ayn Rand had a good term, which is called a package deal, where someone is, in their language, they're blending together two different contradictory ideas that don't belong together. And if we think about impacting nature, well, there's at least two big categories of that. One is impacting nature in a way that helps our lives, such as, say, building a new hospital, building a shopping mall, building a new house, drilling for oil, etc. And the other is impacting nature in a way that harms our lives, such as dumping stuff into a lake, spewing smoke into your neighbor's yard, etc., etc. Now, in the law, that's been demarcated for I don't know how many centuries, but well over a century, where you have property rights, and that handles that issue properly. So you can buy a piece of property, and you can shape it to maximally benefit you, which includes, everything from drilling for oil to making a garden to even just leaving something be so you can contemplate its natural beauty. But then at the same time, you and others are protected from others polluting your property, because that is a violation of property rights. So if someone is actually interested in just having a healthy environment for human beings to live in, they would be avid supporters of capitalism. But why would you would never think of it in terms of impacting nature as bad or impacting, quote, the environment as bad, because you would realize that, no, our whole means of survival, our whole improvement in industrialization, the whole tripling of the life expectancy has involved massively, massively impacting the environment. But it's impacting the environment to benefit humans. So the fact that they think of it in terms of we shouldn't impact the environment really means that they're not really concerned with having a healthy place for humans to live. It's really that there's some hostility toward industrialization. And that's why I keep putting it in terms of an anti-capitalist mentality, because industrialization is really part and was a phenomenon of capitalism and is really an essential component of capitalism. So what you have historically is, on one side, you've got the industrialization of capitalist countries, and on the other side, you have people who are against that for various religious and philosophical reasons. And the people against it, who ultimately become the socialists, the communists, who we can call the left, they're always looking for reasons why this is bad, even though in terms of its demonstrable impact on human life, it's extremely, extremely good. And throughout, over time, different arguments against capitalism become more or less prominent. So at first it was the whole communist argument, but then communism bombed. And then for a while, in America at least, they're focused on this angle that capitalism leads to war. They were focused on the Vietnam War for all the wrong reasons. But then that kind of died. And so then what they did is they pulled up this idea of environmentalism, which had always been around. It's been around for centuries, but they really made it front and center of the left. And the left, it became the new communism for the left, the new crusade to say, okay, capitalism is, okay, fine, we have to admit it produces more than communism, but it's still evil because it, quote, destroys the planet.
That's a great answer. Let me turn for a minute to politics, because you mentioned the left, but the conservatives, the Republicans, are always characterized as being pro-business, pro-capitalist, yet when I look at the results of Republican administrations and Republican Congresses, I see just the opposite. So how is it that these guys have gotten this reputation? Are they just living on some historical legacy? And you know, is there any hope for the future in having a group that actually truly is pro-business and pro-capitalism?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, as you know, I recently released an essay. There's a new book called Why Businessmen Need Philosophy. And I co-authored with Yaron Brook, who's the president of the Ayn Rand Institute, an essay called Why Conservatives Can't Stop the Growth of the State. And that is an attempt to answer this kind of question, which is, you know, why is it that these people who are seemingly the defenders of capitalism, which is something that certainly deserves to be defended, and it's one of the greatest things that's ever happened in history if you look at impact on human life, why is it that we keep going further and further from capitalism? The government, most prominently we see today, the government just keeps getting bigger and bigger, even under conservative heroes like Reagan. Why does this happen? And, well, I don't want to give too much of it away, because you guys should go read the book. One of the things the essay observes is that if you look at it's helpful to look at the arguments and to look at the debate over these issues. And one thing, if you look at the debate, you'll notice that certain liberal arguments always keep winning out. And I call these two main arguments. There are two categories of arguments that always win out. And one is called the argument from greed, and the other is called the argument from need. So the argument from greed, and an example of this is, say, the financial crisis, where people say, well, what caused this giant financial crisis? Well, greedy businessmen. I mean, look, you know, we saw people going after money. They really wanted a lot of money. Some of them made money, some of them lost money. Then we had a disaster, so greed must be responsible. And then the argument from need is, you'll see with especially welfare programs, wealth transfer programs, look, people need health care. They need health insurance. They need, they need to go to college. So the government needs a program to satisfy all these needs. And what's behind both of these arguments is that as a country, we've never really learned to value self-interest, even though we're the most self-interested country in history in terms of, if you look at how we've actually lived our lives, especially in the 19th century, and how people function under capitalism. It's completely a system of self-interest, and it illustrates a profound truth about self-interest, which is that self-interest is not about exploiting others. It's about producing value and trading with others, and it's a mutually beneficial phenomenon. But we've never really embraced it or understood it, and therefore we're vulnerable to the idea that, say, greed is the cause of the financial crisis, which, if you look at, it's not an explanation at all to say greed is the cause of the financial crisis. I mean, the financial crisis is the corruption of greed, or the corruption of self-interest by government, because it's the Federal Reserve and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac incentivizing people. It's paying people to do irrational things, like lend out money for home loans that they would not lend out under a free market. So whereas in a truly free market where true self-interest is pursued, people wouldn't be making a lot of bad loans, because they would lose financially from it. When the government incentivizes it, then they gain from it. So the whole analysis, and you can see this with so many other crises, it's the government's distortion of self-interest. And then the argument from need, if you really value self-interest, you really ask yourself, well, why does the fact that one guy needs something, that he lacks it, that he's failed to get it, why does that entitle him to get it from someone who's produced it? Because if the selfishness that got the haves, sometimes they call people the haves, if the haves get their things legitimately and honestly, how is it moral to sacrifice them to the have-nots? That still leaves open the question of, do the more productive people in certain cases want to help others with charity, or do they just help them in the way that they help them normally, which is just through trade? Those are open questions, but this whole idea that need is a claim, if you really understand and value self-interest, that idea becomes a very unjust idea. And for more on this, definitely check out the book, but if you haven't read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, certainly check that out before anything, because that's the ultimate book on all of these issues.
Absolutely. We love Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged, and the book that Mr. Epstein is referring to is Why Businessmen Need Philosophy. It's just been re-released It was released many years ago, and they took it off and added some new articles, polished it up, and it's better than ever. So I highly recommend it. You can get it at the Ayn Rand bookstore, or you can get it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you know, wherever you buy books. If they don't have it, tell them to get it.
Let's talk and see if we can apply the theory of need that you're talking about with alternative energy, because it seems like the numbers here just have a lot of trouble working out in reality, but people just say, I have a need for this renewable energy with zero carbon emissions, and so therefore go do it. And they don't slow down and say, that's an impossible dream. We need to look at the math first.
So what's the question exactly?
Do you think that people trying to build alternative energy plans and programs, do you think they are, is that a rational desire or is that an emotional desire?
I think I mentioned before with all these things like alternative energy and peak oil, there's always this anti-capitalist component. And that's really the key to it. It's because you can have a capitalist view, but with any given amount of oil reserves, you can have a pro-capitalist approach or an anti-capitalist approach. And with any given state of viability of alternatives to, say, coal, oil, and natural gas, which are the three leading forms of energy, you could have a pro-capitalist or an anti-capitalist. And they often try to, so even the whole framing of alternative energy, the whole implication is that this group of people is somehow pro-alternative to, they're somehow pro-new, exciting alternative things, and then there's a group of us who are anti-new, exciting alternative things. And there's no such group of people who have some sort of religious devotion to oil or coal or natural gas. The reason that I really like oil and I study oil. I write about it all the time. I really admire the industry. But if someone comes up with something that's better than oil, am I really going to just be attached to oil? That would be crazy. So there's no issue of we'll talk about global warming in a second, but under just the normal market, leaving aside the issue of global warming, there's no such issue as we need, culturally or certainly politically, we need to be devoted to finding alternatives. That oil itself was the original alternative energy. And the question is, at any stage of the market, is what is the best, cheapest way of doing X? And in this case, X is power, or in the case of oil, it's specifically portable power. So what is the best, cheapest way of producing portable power? And people should think about that, and they should compete and innovate accordingly. And for a long time, the best alternative to oil has been more oil. And I'm happy for that to continue as long or as short as it makes sense. So this whole idea that somehow, I heard Nancy Pelosi the other day say something like, she was explaining to a bunch of kids why we kept using oil, and she said, yeah, we haven't been very foresighted. And I don't want to say what went through my mind, but I mean, and then Nancy Pelosi has the gall to act as if she somehow knows some form of energy that can replace the billion gallons of oil that we Americans use every day, and that if only she had had more say in the matter, she would have found something that could do it for half the price or half the volatility. It's just this incredible statist mentality that has contempt for the freedom and the free choices of individuals. So really, alternative energy, that whole movement, it's an alternative to capitalism, or an alternative to what actually, to the energy that actually wins on a competitive market. Now, one way in which this is obscured is, not the only way, but one way, is the whole global warming thing. And what they'll say is, well, the outcome of the market is, if they're an economist, they'll call it a market failure. And they'll say, well, there's this externality, there's this negative, this negative consequence of climate change, and therefore, and the market price isn't taking that into account. And the basic objectivist view on this kind of thing is, I mentioned this in another connection before, is you have to distinguish between protecting rights and violating rights. So with something like global warming, if you can really prove, and they can't get anywhere near this, if you can really prove that people emitting things is causing some sort of incredible catastrophe of this, you know, the sort of thing where you need to quarantine people or whatever, if you can really prove that this is true, then do it. You know, go to a court of law and prove it. But you can't have this ambiguous mandate where you get to say, hey, you know, we're pretty sure, you know, it's bad to emit CO2, so give us complete arbitrary power and we're just going to randomly fund this solar farm and this, you know, this set of windmills and this thing that allegedly can produce the whole nation's power from a leaf or whatever kind of things you'll see.
Right.
That is a, so it becomes this pretext for arbitrary power, whereas what's needed when there are legitimate pollution issues, and I do not regard global warming as one of them, but where there are legitimate pollution issues, you need specific objective laws based on real violations of individual rights. But for various reasons, the people who are in this movement particularly like the idea of undefined arbitrary power with that people can't understand, that they can't question, that we basically just say, okay, we're sinners, we'll give you the power, you solve it. That there's this kind of authoritarian thing that they really, that goes part and parcel with any sort of, I'd call it a religious type movement. Because again, there's not, I mean, I'm not a scientific expert on this, but the way that they portray their alleged certainty in what's going to happen is so divorced from what they actually know. And it has a very religious authoritarian character to it, and it's very reminiscent of previous dictatorial movements. It's not, if you are a scientific movement, you do not go around scaring 7-year-olds with certain predictions of climate doom that they're in no position to understand.
That's really well said there. I was wondering about, it seems like global warming is kind of getting less popular, getting less press these days. And, you know, we've seen this progression that the environmentalists had global cooling and acid rain and the hole in the ozone layer and global warming. Do you think that they are about ready to switch to a new scare?
I don't know. I would hope so, but I don't think so. I think they feel like, because if you look at it, I think there would need to be either some real proper education about A, the state of the so-called science on this and the whole science by consensus, which is just the opposite of science. So one thing would be to challenge the whole scientific distortion, the whole method that's going on. But then the other side would be to challenge the whole devaluing of industrial energy. So even if you think that, so let's say you think that, you know, there's the greenhouse effect, which, by the way, is not what global warming is really about. So there's greenhouse effect, which on every climate scientist terms would lead to, you know, at most a mild amount of warming. But then they have all these theories where the greenhouse effect is allegedly going to lead to all of these crazy positive feedback loops that are going to lead to, you know, some negative thing. If you really think that we're going to have all sorts of climate disruptions and really out of the normal, the first thing that should go on your mind is, okay, well, what's the best thing that we can do to deal with that? And at the top of the list is going to have to be, we need a lot of energy to protect ourselves from it. Because if you look at what makes people less vulnerable to the climate, it's more and more and more energy. That's what enables us to build sturdy structures. You know, that's what enables us to protect ourselves from the elements. That's what gives us heating or air conditioning or sunscreen or all the other things that make us uniquely able to cope with climate. And yet the solution, alleged solution here of a problem with the climate, which really translates into a problem with the weather, is to deprive us of our means of coping with the weather, namely fossil fuels. And there's this rationalization of alternative energy, but as we've talked about, that hasn't, and there's no evidence that it will compete on the market, certainly not with very diffuse and intermittent sources like solar and wind. So the whole, there's such a lack of appreciation of industrial energy and such a dogmatism with this pseudoscience by from authority and by, allegedly by consensus, that's pretty steep right now. So I don't see them giving up that. I mean, they spent decades building that up as, so I don't see them giving that up. But if they do, so I guess I would say there's a lot to fight about there. And you'd have to have, you know, I think a couple decades where just the temperatures went in a completely different way. And once again, their predictions are wrong. But as I understand it, their predictions were wrong about the last decade, and they just changed their models retroactively to account for those, you know, the specific things. So
if you don't like the graph, just change the graph.
Yeah, you know, it's really remarkable what people will do when they are, when they're convinced that they're right in an emotional but not rational way, because in their mind it will justify so many distortions. And there's even a guy, very famous climate guy, Steven Schneider, and this may not be an exact quote, but it's not an exaggeration. He said, you know, we have to decide the right balance between, you know, being accurate and being effective and being truthful.
Good grief. That's amazing. I know we're running a little bit short on time here, but I did want to ask one question about this, because I've talked about this issue with other objectivist scholars. And, you know, when we drill down on this, every single time we always get to the issue of education. I mean, that no matter, it seems, what the topic is, whether it's environmentalism or whether it's some other topical issue, when we drill back, what we always seem to arrive at is a poor and degrading educational system, that children are simply not taught how to think critically, especially. So I mean, would you credit a lot of the environmentalist success in the left's control of the educational system? I mean, you mentioned, environmentalists scaring 7-year-olds. Well, that's a pretty good example of, you know, any rational educator would have kicked somebody in the behind for doing that.
So I mean, if the question definitely the left has, if you look at from K to PhD, they dominate the educational system. Now, as I think I indicated before, I'm not a conservative, but this is just the way it is. Particularly the government education system, but they are omnipresent, and in two ways this is destructive. One is that the content of the education gets progressively leftist, in particular, it becomes, you know, very statist. So people very much learn to think of themselves as, you know, serving some quote higher cause, serving the government, devoting their lives to solving all of these alleged problems created by mostly businessmen. So part of it is the content, but even more destructive, and this is a whole issue in itself, but it's just the method. And you mentioned lack of ability to think critically, and that's definitely a key part of it, where people just don't know what it means to know something. And therefore, it's very easy for them to swallow things, and it can be hard to challenge what they've swallowed if those things are popular. So if we just go to the global warming issue again, I've had PhDs, I think, come to me and say utterances like the following: you don't believe in climate change? Now, if you just dissect that sentence, like, what the heck does that sentence even mean? Like, does it mean that I don't believe that the climate changes, that I don't believe that humans have caused it, that I don't believe that it's catastrophic, that I don't believe that humans have caused catastrophic, that I don't believe it's CO2? It's such a piece of garbage as far as a mental utterance, in terms of the utter ambiguity of it. And then the motive behind it is just completely tribal and partisan, that either I'm on his side or I'm not. And he wants to know how to categorize me. So it's not an intellectual sort of statement. And yet you hear these kinds of things all the time. And the whole method of thinking is really off. Now, you mentioned you discussed this with, you know, different objectivist scholars, and So I don't know exactly what they would say or not say. But one thing that's important, though, I think, is that education is a lifetime endeavor. So it is very important that people get educated as well as possible, as early as possible. But for any of us as individuals, we don't have the option of going back in time and giving ourselves a better education than we had. We do have the option of learning critical thinking skills now and educating others. And that includes, you know, maybe we'll be in a position where we educate children. I'm not primarily in that position. I'm mostly dealing with educating adults. But it's important to think of it as education, because what you're doing is you're giving people the right facts, and what you're trying to give them is the right way of thinking about those facts. And the more people get exposed to examples of the right way of thinking about facts, the more independent thinkers they become. And to the extent I'm right about something, I'm not really concerned in any given instance with, does the person agree 100% with my conclusion? I'm concerned with, does he agree that he really needs to think about this in a way that takes into account the whole context, that's objective, that really values human life, et cetera, et cetera. And the more people learn to do that, I think the better off we are. So there's a large role today. There's a lot of education happening outside schools, and I think people should very much embrace their role in that and take leadership positions in that. Otherwise, you know, the left or the conservatives will take the role where you don't.
Right.
Okay, we're running a little low on time, but I wanted to give you a chance. Is there any big pressing issues on your mind that we haven't gotten to yet?
Any big pressing issues on my mind? Well, I write about oil a lot, so I'm thinking about that a lot. But I mentioned before, I would just say that from a positive perspective, because we have talked about a lot of negative things, but I think part of being able to fight negative things effectively is to just realize how amazing some of the positives in our culture are, and particularly the things that are often thought of as grimy or dirty, like oil and coal and natural gas. These things are real. I often call oil, when I give lectures about it, I call it liquid Superman, because it really gives us the power of Superman. I mean, you know, Superman, you know, can lift things, he can fly, he can heat things up. I mean, if we were Superman, we wouldn't need industrial power. We could just do everything by hand. But what it's enabled us, as small and as puny as we are, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, I just mean that as a straight statement of physical fact, it enables us to do these incredible things. So I just encourage people, look at the world around you and be curious about it. Ask yourself, where did this come from? What made it possible? One of the big answers to that is energy. And then one of the bigger answers to that is freedom. And then one of the bigger answers to that is a certain kind of cultural philosophy that led to freedom, that led to science, that led to technology. And that's really what Ayn Rand was all about in terms of what she focused on in her life and in her work. And that's why Atlas Shrugged is the best book anyone can read if they really want to understand the world. But I'd say look at it in a positive way. Be curious about it, to learn about it, and then also take seriously when people attack it. Because if you hear people attacking oil, that means they're attacking the food on your table, paint on your wall, the asphalt on your roads, the transportation of people who are going to your wedding. And you need to take that seriously.
Well, thanks. That's been a really insightful interview. I've really enjoyed it a lot.
Indeed. That was great.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's been my pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed the interview. I certainly did. Remember that you can reach Jeff at Jeff@RationalPublicRadio or Scott at Scott@RationalPublicRadio. We'd love to hear your feedback, your fan mail, your occasional weird criticisms, whatever you've got for us, we love. Remember to subscribe on iTunes. Remember to give us a review there. We really appreciate the reviews. Last, please remember to like us on Facebook. You can find that at our main page, rationalpublicradio.com, or you can go to Facebook and search for Rational Public Radio. Thank you and have a great afternoon.